So this afternoon, we're focusing on an issue that we know is of great interest, the role of employers under the new health care reform law, and what you need to do immediately and in the future. We're very pleased to have with us two attorneys from organizations that partner with ASA who are experts in the employee. David Sanders is a member of Aon's National Tax and ERISA practice working out of the Baltimore office. He has 23 years of experience in the benefits field. He reviews contracts, insurance policies, plan documents, and other materials on behalf of Aon clients. Sora Johnson is a partner in the D.C.-based law firm of Venable in the Employee Benefits and Executive Compensation Group. She specializes in health and welfare plans. David is going to begin with an overview of key employer-related provisions in health care reform. Sora will then discuss the timeline, when provisions go into effect, and next steps for employers. We will reserve the last portion of today's call for your questions. Resources can be seen on pages 25 and 26 of the handout, the PowerPoint, that has speaker info plus websites where you can find more information. And these include ASA's own Health Reform Hub, where we will be posting a copy of the PowerPoint and also a recording of this session. Thanks so much for participating with us today. And David, would you like to begin?
Thank you, Barbara, for that kind introduction. Let's turn to slide 4. Where we talk about some of the implementation challenges associated with healthcare reform. This was an extremely complex bill that was crafted over many, many months. It's a two-part bill. There was the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act that was enacted and followed 7 days later by the Reconciliation Bill. The organization that's chiefly in charge of issuing guidance is the Department of Health and Human Services. However, there will also be guidance issued separately and together with the Department of Labor, as well as the Internal Revenue Service. This law has a very early effective date in some instances, as soon as 6 months after the date of enactment, which was March 23rd of this year. The last bullet on that page is a critical point because it refers to something called grandfathered plans. And what that means is that if the plan was in existence on the date of enactment, March 23rd, and it remains substantially unchanged, and we don't know exactly what that means yet, pending further guidance from the regulators, then it will be exempt from many, but not necessarily all, of the provisions of health care reform. Turning to the next slide, we'll dive right into the market reform aspects of the law. I'm sure you've all heard about the extension of dependent coverage to children up to age 26, regardless of marital or student status. This is becoming effective within if you have a calendar year health plan year. There will be an exclusion for grandfather plans where you can exclude those who are eligible for other group health plan coverage. That exclusion goes away at the end of 2013. Again, it only applies to grandfather plans. It also is worth noting that this provision applies even if a child is not a tax dependent. And the IRS issued guidance several weeks ago about how that would play out. You may have heard from your carriers already where they are voluntarily extending this coverage through age 26, some as soon as June 1st, prior to the effective date of the law. This was an initiative that the Department of Health and Human Services threw out to the health insurance community, and many health carriers responded positively. And there is a list of all the carriers who have agreed to accelerate the expansion to children up to age 26, a list on the Department of Health and Human Services website. Next topic under the market reform aspect of the law is the elimination of lifetime and annual maximums. Now, there will continue to be permitted some annual and lifetime limits on specific non-essential health benefits, but for the most part, beginning January 1st, 2011, calendar year plans, The annual limits and lifetime limits will be eliminated for essential health benefits, subject to a few exceptions caused by a transition rule that will allow the Department of Health and Human Services to identify by guidance through 2014, those type of essential services will be subject to annual limits. Turning to the next slide. There is going to be a elimination of the pre-existing condition exclusion rules for children under age 19, effective January 1st for calendar year plans. Then starting in January 1st, 2014, that will be expanded so they're no longer allowed to have pre-existing condition exclusions with respect to any plan enrollee. Similar to the expansion of coverage to dependents up to age 26, Department of Health and Human Services approached carriers and asked them to consider accelerating this provision prior to the effective date required by law. And again, if you look at the website for the Department of Health and Human Services, you will see a listing of a number of health insurance carriers, regional as well as national, who have agreed to eliminate the pre-existing condition exclusion for children under age 19, again, as soon, in some cases, as June 1st. For those of you who have plans with waiting periods, and that, quite frankly, that's a lot of plans, starting in 2014, your waiting periods may be no greater than 90 days. So if you have, for example, a six-month waiting period, by 2014, you will have to ratchet that back to no longer than 90 days. The bottom right-hand corner of slide six, it talks about preventive benefits. These are things such as immunizations, mammograms, and so forth. Plans starting January 1st, 2011 for calendar year plans must provide first dollar coverage for what's referred to as evidence-based preventive care. This is going to be, there is an exemption under this particular rule for grandfathered plans. So if you have a grandfathered plan, this is something that you would not have to provide the first dollar coverage for preventive care starting next year. Now slide seven talks about what's called the free rider provision. You know, in essence, what this free rider provision means is that an employer who either offers no health benefits, who's offering unaffordable health benefits, or whose employees are paying a substantial portion of their wages for the benefits that are being offered, will have to begin paying an assessment. So it's a method of the government of attempting to drive employers in the direction of providing coverage that is both affordable as well as robust. But at the same time, if you as an employer make a decision not to go this route, then you can pay the assessment and not have to pursue that requirement. That will become effective in 2014. The next segment of that slide talks about the employee voucher. It is possible for employees who will be paying between 8 and 9.8% of their household income coverage to opt out of an employer-sponsored plan and elect coverage under an exchange-based plan. This law, as you have heard, sets up things that are referred to as health insurance exchanges, which will be open marketplaces for health insurance carriers to vie for the business of individuals. And in effect, what this is going to be doing is going to be pitting employer-based plans against these health insurance exchange plans for individuals who will be paying greater than between 8 and 9.8% of their household income for health coverage under an employer plan, because they can opt out and receive a voucher from their employer for the amount of the employer subsidy that's currently being paid towards their health coverage, take that to the marketplace, and use it to purchase health insurance from the exchange-based plan. That goes into effect also in 2014. Slide number eight talks about auto enrollment in the upper left-hand corner. Some of you may have 401k plans with auto enrollment features. This is very similar in concept to that. It will apply to new hires only, and effectively they will, this again also applies only to employers with greater than 200 employees. So if you have less than 200 employees, this will not affect you. But if you have greater than 200 employees, your employees, well, your new hires will be automatically enrolled in whatever the default option is under your health plan. Although they will be able to opt out if they so elect, and that will go into effect January 1st, 2011 or later, depending upon when the Department of Labor gets around to issuing guidance. The bottom left-hand quadrant of that slide talks about the fact that employers will have to notify employees at the date of hire of the availability of exchanges and their potential eligibility for a subsidy to purchase exchange-based health insurance depending on the employee's income. Again, there's nothing that requires an employer to match these exchange-based plans, but instead it's just simply a part of the whole transparency issue with respect to this law that is requiring employers to notify employees of the existence of these plans and that will become effective March 1st, 2013. On the right-hand side of slide 8, there are a number of provisions of the law that relate to what we refer to as account-based plans. So for example, if you're offering a flexible spending account, or if your organization has a health reimbursement arrangement, or is offering health savings accounts in conjunction with a consumer-driven health plan, a high deductible plan, starting next year, over-the-counter drugs will no longer be allowed to be reimbursed under those arrangements. That means for many of you that you may have to do an amendment to those plans, and Tora will be talking about that shortly. Down at the bottom, the third bullet talks about the fact that for health FSAs, beginning in 2013, they will be limited to $2,500 in terms of the maximum annual contribution that an employee can make to their FSA. Currently, there are effectively no limits, and these are entirely up to the design established by the employer as to what they want to set by way of a maximum annual limit. And there are many plans with maximum annual limits in the $4,000 to $5,000 range. So this will be a rather severe cutback for employees that have been utilizing those type of health FSAs to the maximum amount under their employer's plan. Turning over to slide 9, W-2 reporting. Effective next year, but not actually kicking in until January 2012, when the W-2s are due to be remitted to the IRS and to employees, employers are going to have to capture the value of the health benefits that they provide to each employee on each employee's W-2 form. That would include things such as medical, dental, vision. It will include both the employer and the employee cost of the health coverage. Value is defined as the COBRA cost. So in effect, you will look to the COBRA cost what is the dollar amount that will be reported on the W-2. This, by the way, does not apply to such coverages as long-term care that might be offered by the employer, disability, accidental death and dismemberment. It's purely group health coverage that's being captured here. Below that, again, getting back to the theme of transparency, the group health plans offered by employers are going to be subject to the same transparency requirements as these so-called exchange-based health plans. That means that data about your claims payment policies, the claims denial ratio, information on cost sharing and payments for out-of-network services, ratings, and so forth, will all have to be captured in a document that will be readily available to employees so that they can go and use that and lay it side by side with the same information provided by an exchange-based plan as a comparison tool. That will go into effect in 2014. Excuse me. In the upper right-hand quadrant of that slide, we talk about something referred to as the Uniform Explanation of Coverage. This is going to be an annual summary that's distributed that in no more than 4 pages encapsulates the significant aspects of the coverages under your health plan in a very rigid format that's going to be spelled out through regulations by the regulators. This will go into effect March 23rd, 2012. And by the way, it's in addition to the summary plan description, or SPD, that you are currently required to provide to your employees under ERISA. Now, for those of you with less than 25 employees who are generally earning less than $50,000 each, you may be eligible for a tax credit towards the employer contributions towards the cost of health insurance. By the way, the employer must be paying at least half of the total cost of the health insurance in order to qualify for this. It will be available for the 2010 to 2013 tax years with a possible 2-year extension thereafter for those who offer an exchange-based health plan to their employees. And also, by the way, it's going to apply to both for-profit as well as not-for-profit organizations. So that's an important point to note if you happen to be a tax-exempt organization. Next slide. There are going to be some key aspects of this law that really focus on wellness. One of them is mentioned here, which is that employers will be permitted to increase the employee reward for participation in a wellness program from the current 20% of total plan cost to 30% of total plan cost, with the possibility that the Department of Health and Human Services may increase that to 50% of plan cost at some future date. That becomes effective in 2014. Grandfathered plans, however, will be exempted from that. Now, for those of you with insured plans, it's worth pointing out that beginning next year, insured plans are going to be subject to non-discrimination rules. Heretofore, your cafeteria plans have been subject to non-discrimination rules. Those of you with self-insured plans have been subject to non-discrimination rules. But those of you with insured plans have never been subject to non-discrimination rules. And effectively, the rules that they will be applying parallel the rules that apply to self-insured plans. So it's a known quantity, but it's a kind of a new process to have to be thinking about if you have an insured plan to ensure that your plan is not discriminatory in favor of highly compensated employees. Again, grandfathered plans will be exempt from that requirement. In the upper right-hand quadrant of this page, we talk about the fact that beginning next year, employer plans will have to have a Department of Health and Human Services approved external review process in place with respect to claims, appeals, and denials. Grandfather plans will be exempt from this. I don't see it having as much impact on insured plans, many of which, because of various state mandates, already offer an external review process. But instead, I think the self-insured plans, those of you who have self-funded health insurance plans, will have to be looking for guidance on how this is going to affect your current mechanism for reviewing claim denials and appeals. Lower right-hand side of this page, we talk about the fact that there are going to be limits on the scope of the out-of-pocket expenses under the health insurance plans that you offer starting effective January 1st, 2014. So out-of-pocket expenses will not be able to exceed the limits that apply to these health savings accounts that you've heard about or you might currently be offered. So currently, for example, the out-of-pocket maximum is $5,950 for individual coverage and $11,900 for family coverage. That will be subject, of course, to cost of living adjustments. Also, your deductibles will not be able to exceed $2,000 for individual coverage and $4,000 for family coverage, again, subject to cost of living increases. Grandfather plans will be exempt from this. So another important feature that grandfathering will protect if you have a grandfather plan. Turning to the next slide, we focus on the CLASS Act. The CLASS Act is a voluntary federal long-term care insurance program. Employers can opt to allow their employees purchase this through payroll withholding, in which case they would auto-enroll employees with an opt-out feature. On the other hand, if an employer chooses not to offer this on a payroll deduction basis to its employees, those individuals will have a mechanism to be established by the Department of Health and Human Services for enrolling in it and having premiums paid monthly, deducted from their checking accounts or what have you. It's going to provide lifetime benefit payments. There will be a five-year vesting period, and that basically means that you have to be in the program for 5 years before you'll be eligible to begin drawing down benefits. That becomes effective next year. We're looking for guidance on that very shortly. Turning to slide 12, other key provisions. Starting this year, 2010, for those of you who offer adoption assistance plans to your employees, the dollar limit has been increased by $1,000. Similarly, there was an amendment in this law to the Fair Labor Standards Act, which requires employers to provide nursing mothers with unpaid breaks and as well as a private lactation room. That cannot be a restroom. It's literally written in the law that the private lactation room is not permitted to be a restroom. Again, they left latitude to the employers as to what otherwise constitutes that would qualify as a private lactation room. Skipping down to the bottom of this chart, in 2018, those of you who have heard of the so-called Cadillac tax on plans that are very high cost very rich health plans. Just wanted to point out that that goes into effect in 2018. It applies to plans which offer benefits that are valued at least $10,200 for individual coverage or $27,500 or more for family coverage. And the tax that will apply is a 40% excise tax on the excess in that's over and above those thresholds, the value of the excess benefits that exceed those thresholds. And that tax will be deducted and paid either by the insurance carrier or by the employer plan. It's simply a mechanism by the government for reining in these type of high-cost plans, as well as generating some revenue, of course. Let's turn over to slide 13. One of the other key revenue raisers are some new taxes on high-income individuals. So if you have an adjusted gross income in excess of $200,000 for an individual or $250,000 for a couple, you will pay an additional Medicare payroll tax on your wages of 0.9%. That's going to be an employee-only payment. There's no comparable employer payment of that 0.9% deducted. There's also going to be a new surtax on investment income of 3.8%. This would include non-wage income, such as rental income, capital gains, dividends, and so forth. This will become effective in 2013 for your high-income individuals. Turning to the next slide, talking about post-retirement medical, the Medicare Part D retiree drug subsidy that has been in effect for employers who continued to provide retiree drug coverage under their retirement medical plan will begin to be taxed, and essentially that would be caused by a loss of the deduction that was previously allowed for these subsidies. Also, there will be a temporary reinsurance program from the government for pre-Medicare retirees who are at least 55 years of age, where the government will reinsure claims covering 80% of costs between $15,000 and up to $90,000 for each pre-age 65 retiree. Point to note, if you have a plan that you think qualifies for this, you should get in line very early, because it's only funded up to a total amount of $5 billion, and guidance was issued by the Department of Health and Human Services on May 5th, and the program is set to go into effect June 1st. The last bullet on this page talks about a topic that, a lot of people have been focusing on, which is the Medicare prescription drug donut hole, which a lot of folks have had a lot of problems with since the Medicare prescription drug program was rolled out. And effectively, that's going to be fully removed by 2020, but it's going to start on a graduated basis next year and be phased in over a number of years. So now I'll turn it over to Tora, who will give you a recap on action plan items.
Thank you, Dave, for that great overview. And now I will walk through a timeline of next steps and concrete action items. It's the second slide, 14, in the deck. Like Dave, I might not be able to touch on each of the points on the slides, but I'll try to highlight the more significant points. First off, if you're an employer with less than 25 full-time employees, you may wish to work with your finance department to evaluate whether you're eligible for the small employer tax credit that Dave mentioned earlier. If so, you may want to apply for that credit. It's designed to encourage small employers to continue or newly offer health coverage. And it's available to both for-profits and tax-exempt organizations, those exempt under 501c of the Internal Revenue Code, including both charities and trade associations, are eligible. To qualify, the small employer must pay at least half the cost of individual coverage under its plan and pay wages averaging less than $50,000 per employee per year. For-profits claim the credit on their tax returns, while tax-exempt organizations take the credit against their payroll taxes. As Dave mentioned, the credit's available now through 2013. Moreover, it continues to be available in 2014 and beyond. But by that time, the credit will only be available to small employers that actually purchase health insurance coverage for their employees on the exchanges. Also, as of 2014, an employer can only claim the credit for 2 consecutive tax years. As such, a small employer can only claim the credit for a maximum of 6 years, 2010, 2015, and then 2 more consecutive years. If you're a for-profit corporation, offer retiree coverage, and receive the Medicare Part D subsidy, you should also work with your finance department and auditors at this point in time to evaluate the impact of the fact that the subsidy will effectively become taxable in 2013, and it may have an impact right now on your current financial statements under the FASB rules. In addition, you may want to review with your actuary whether the shrinking of the donut hole, your retiree prescription drug coverage will continue to be deemed the actuarial equivalent of Medicare Part D. If it won't, then you may lose eligibility for the Medicare Part D subsidy. And then, as Dave just mentioned, if you offer retiree coverage for early retirees, those between age 55 and 65, and who are not yet eligible for Medicare, you may want to apply for the retiree reinsurance program, and it is important to act quickly. The information that's going to be required on the application has been released. It includes very detailed claims information, including a projection of what you think you'll be able to recoup under the program for the next 2 years, and a description of the plans, policies, and procedures to avoid fraud and abuse. So although the applications aren't currently available, it's not too soon to begin to collect that information. Now on to slide 15. As you look forward to plan year 2011, you'll need to evaluate your group health plans and determine whether any of them need to be restructured in light of health care reform. First, you'll want to determine whether you have any grandfathered plans. As Dave discussed earlier, grandfather plans are those that were in effect on March 23rd and have remained unchanged. It's important because many of the new coverage provisions don't actually apply to grandfather plans, or there are modifications of the rules and how they apply. We've indicated on the slides those coverage provisions that do apply to grandfather plans with a grandfathered clock on the right-hand column. And we're expecting guidance any day now on exactly the parameters of grandfather status and what amendments might take you out of grandfather status. So stay tuned. Second, you'll want to take a close look at your dental and vision coverage and see if any of them need to be converted to, quote, standalone, quote, plans. This is because standalone dental and vision plans are exempt from many of the new rules, including those on annual and lifetime maximums. Standalone dental and vision plans are those that are unbundled for the major medical plan. To unbundle them, there's a couple things you need to do, but primarily you need to be charging a separate premium for dental and vision than you are for the major medical. Third, you'll want to review any of your executive-only fully insured group health plans, and to the extent that you've established them after March 23rd, the date of enactment, you'll need to see if they need to be restructured to comply with the new non-discrimination rules that apply to fully insured plans now. Didn't used to, but now they do. And you'll want to consider whether to offer your employees the opportunity to participate in the Class Act program, that new voluntary self-funded long-term care plan to provide community living assistance services that Dave discussed. You want to know if you want, you'll have to decide whether you want to allow your employees to participate at work through payroll deductions. You may also want to consider applying for grants newly available to small employers that offer wellness programs to their employees. Specifically, beginning in 2011, grants will be available for a 5-year period for certain programs sponsored by small employers with less than 100 employees who work 25 or more hours per week. And to be eligible, the employer has to have a new wellness program as of March 23rd, 2010. It has to be a newly created wellness program. And the program has to have certain elements such as health awareness initiatives, including preventative screenings, efforts to maximize employee participation, and supportive employer efforts such as workplace policies to encourage physical activity and healthy eating. Now on to slide on page 16. This slide highlights all the amendments necessary to your major medical plan for the 2011 plan year in light of the reforms, new coverage, and limit provisions that Dave has discussed. note, the chart is key for a calendar year plan. So to the extent that your plan doesn't operate on a calendar year plan, you'll need to check dates for non-calendar year plans. Whether or not your plan is grandfathered, it's going to need to be amended. For example, you're going to have to remove lifetime dollar maximums, carve back annual limits, and remove pre-existing condition exclusions for children under age 19. Again, the grandfather clock means those plan provisions do apply to grandfathered plans. In addition, the plan amendments will need to address the expanded dependent eligibility. In other words, the fact that children up to age 26 need to be offered coverage if the plan otherwise provides dependent coverage. All deductibles, co-pays, and co-insurance required for preventive care will need to be eliminated if the plan is not grandfathered. Furthermore, if the plan is not grandfathered, it will need to be amended to be updated with the new internal and external appeals procedures that Dave mentioned. And there'll be more guidance on what those will look like in the near future. Next slide, slide 17. As part of the amendment process, you may wish to consider whether there are additional design changes you can make to offset some of the anticipated increases in plan costs due to the required amendments. For instance, you might consider placing a limit on the number of covered visits to certain specialists. However, caution has to be taken not to combine a visit limit with a limit on the amount payable per visit, because that might result in an impermissible constructive annual or lifetime maximum. And many employers were wondering if they were going to be able to charge a surcharge, a special premium for older dependent coverage. Well, the guidance that came out last week has clarified that point, and that won't be a measure you'll be able to take to realize some cost savings. There will be no tolerance of a surcharge for older dependents. In addition to amending your major medical plan, you'll need to amend your medical FSA plan for 2011 to eliminate the reimbursement for over-the-counter drugs unless prescribed by a doctor. If you're a small employer, you may also wish to consider establishing a simple plan to avoid cafeteria plan non-discrimination testing. Cafeteria plans are the plans that permit your employees to pay their premiums for health care on a pre-tax basis. These plans are subject to non-discrimination tests. However, if you implement a simple plan, you have a safe harbor and you won't have to test the plan. But to be eligible, you have to make certain contributions and comply with certain participation requirements. Finally, with all the 2011 changes, you'll need to provide notice to your participants. There's a new requirement to give advance notice of changes. If your plan changes in any way for 2011, and it will, notices of those changes need to be provided to participants 60 days before the end of 2010, or by November 1st for a calendar year plan. This means that new SPDs or SMMs capturing the amendments you make will need to be finalized early this fall so that they can be distributed before November 1st. Also, you may need to review any primary or stop-loss insurance applicable to your group health plan. Most of the amendments we just referred to increase the benefits that are offered, and you'll want to make sure that you've considered and adjusted your insurance levels given these increased benefits. Slide 18. You'll also want to review your contracts with TPAs and other claims administrators. There's a new requirement that insurance companies issue certain reports to HHS, known as medical loss ratio reports. A medical loss ratio is the percentage of premium revenue, the revenue the insurance company gets in premiums, and you need to know how much they expend of that premium revenue on medical care as opposed to administrative costs. If the ratio is not at least 85% for large group market or 80% for small group market, then the insurance carrier must issue a rebate to your covered participants. So you want to make sure that your insurance carriers are complying with this new reporting requirement. It's an incentive for them to spend more of their premiums on actual medical care rather than administrative expenses. You'll also need to determine with your TPA who will be making the required transparency disclosures regarding claim payments that Dave discussed. And then moving on to working with your payroll department to implement W-2 reporting changes. As Dave mentioned, beginning in 2011, you'll need to report on the W-2, the aggregate cost of employer health coverage received by each employee, So it applies to the 2011 year, and those W-2s are actually issued in January of 2012. So you just want to begin getting your implementation process in place. And the purpose isn't to tax you on your employer-provided health coverage. It's simply to allow the government to track employer-provided health coverage and to make sure people are maintaining individual coverage. Next slide, 19. And as we just discussed, when talking about updating your TPA agreements, you just need to make sure that the actual transparency and medical loss ratio notices are being provided to HHS. Now let's turn to things that happened in 2012. With all the changes to Medicare Advantage plans under health care reform and to provider payments, if you provide retiree health benefits, you'll need to review the impact of coordinating these benefits with Medicare. Also, before March 23, 2012, the new concise user-friendly plain language plan summary, as Dave mentioned, will need to be drafted for each group health plan and distributed to participants. You'll also need to update your TPA agreements to address the new 2012 required reporting to HHS on your medical plans programs to improve the quality of care. In other words, there's a new reporting requirement that you need to tell HHS about management and other wellness and health promotion activities, although this requirement does not apply to grandfathered plans. Next slide. A number of changes take place in 2013 that you may want to begin thinking about towards the end of 2012. As Dave mentioned, if you offer medical flexible spending accounts, you'll need to amend the plan document to impose the new $2,500 limit on annual contributions, and you'll need to work with payroll to make sure that no more than that is actually withheld in wages, and that the appropriate amount of Medicare taxes is withheld from high-income earners. It's an additional 0.9% Medicare tax paid by an individual on wages in excess of $250,000 for married couples filing jointly and $200,000 for individuals. If you're for-profit, you'll need to work with your finance department because the Medicare Part D subsidy will now essentially be taxable. You'll no longer be able to deduct it. And there'll be new premium payments, or you'll be subject to a per participant fee or premium tax of $1 per covered life in 2013. And finally, by March 1st, 2013, you are required to give all your current employees notice regarding the availability of the state insurance exchanges. And as Dave mentioned, from that date going forward, you'll have to provide the same notice to new hires. Slide 21. You can expect four significant action items to occur before 2014. If you're a small employer, meaning fewer than 50 full-time employees, you will have access to the state insurance exchanges beginning January 1, 2014. Decisions will have to be made regarding whether you want to utilize the exchanges. If you're a large employer, meaning you have 50 or more full-time employees, you'll have significant design decisions. You might, you'll have to decide whether you're going to continue to offer coverage or whether you'd rather pay the penalties that Dave discussed. And there are additional plan amendments that need to be made before 2014. For example, next slide, 22, plans will need to be amended to remove waiting periods exceeding 90 days and to remove all pre-existing condition exclusions that still apply to individuals over age 19. Under age 19, they have to be removed as of January 1, 2011 for calendar year plans. Again, you'll want to review your primary and stop loss insurance to make sure that they're adjusted consistently with that, with those requirements. And there are new notices to the IRS required regarding employer-provided coverage. And the purpose of the new notices is to help the IRS oversee the new penalty regime. And with that, the last slide, let's look at 2017 and 2018, which is far away. If you're in 2017, large employers, those with 50 or more employees, will now have access to state insurance exchanges. And finally, in 2018, the Cadillac tax kicks in, and if you offer one, you may see if you can restructure it to minimize or avoid the penalty. If not, the penalty, as Dave mentioned, is imposed on the self-funded health plan, on the employer, and if you're fully insured on the insurance company, but it's fully expected that those taxes will be passed on to participants. And with that, I'll turn the program back over to Barbara, who will take questions.
Thanks so much, Tori. We have had a number of questions coming in, and we will attempt to get to all of them. If we do run out of time, we will try to get answers for you and respond to you individually. Our first question came on current increases in premiums. Our member asks, our organization just received notice of a 51% increase in premiums for our group health plan. The organization currently pays 75% of premium costs for the option chosen by the employee. The company is finding this unaffordable. Is there anything in the health care reform law that addresses immediate premium increases?
Well, there is a new process in place where insurance commissioners are supposed to be reviewing premium increases to see whether or not they are reasonable. I don't know when they kick in, but that's definitely a provision that you'd want to look at.
If you're a small employer, you can also think about the tax credit.
Right.
But again, that's real small, less than 25 employees, the average of less than $50,000 per employee in wages.
Yeah.
So that's an option, but only for a very limited universe of employers.
Mm-hmm. Now, what would happen if the employer were to drop the current group coverage and just essentially give the employees a voucher of up to 75% of the cost of an individual plan? Would that have implications for their obligations coming up under health care reform?
Ultimately, they're going to be subject to the free rider assessment if they're not offering insurance coverage at all.
That's right. I agree with that. If they have at least 50 employees,
yeah.
And the value of the policies at which the tax would begin to apply, how is the value determined? Is it the sum of the premiums paid by the employer and the employee, or how is that going to be figured out?
My understanding is the total cost of coverage. And it's not supposed to be reduced, for example, by any employee salary reduction payments towards that.
Right.
So it's the gross cost, not the net cost.
Although I think you're allowed to carve out dental and vision. While you cannot carve those out for the W-2 reporting, I believe you can carve them out for Cadillac tax purposes.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Another question. In terms of the federal poverty level requirements for providing coverage, what if the coverage for the employee is less than 9.5% of household income, but family coverage is more? Are employers responsible for family coverage? And if there are two working adults, how is it decided how is it decided what each employer's responsibility is? In other words, you've got two employers in the picture.
That is a great question, and one of the questions I keep getting is that 9.5% triggered by individual coverage or family coverage? And I don't think we have a clear answer to that yet, although my best reading, I'll be interested what Dave has to say, but my best reading is that it is probably if they have dependent coverage, family coverage.
Yeah, I don't know that there's a firm answer to that either, Tora. I think that's something that, we're going to get some guidance on and hopefully in the not-too-distant future.
But because penalties are triggered unless you offer coverage to both the employee and dependents, and it talks about the employee's premium, I suspect it's going to be family coverage if you have dependents.
Okay.
But the whole issue about coordinating between multiple employers is going to be a really thorny one.
Right. And I think another question that's been very common is, how will I know if it's above 9.5% of my, because it's based on family income? And rest assured, you're not going to be needing to gather the financial information of your employees and their spouses. The government is supposed to issue you a report, you the employer, as to whether you or not you have employees who are eligible for a subsidy on the exchanges.
That's good to know, because that answers another question that we've gotten. Another question is, how will we determine if our health plan will meet the requirements of the reform law?
Now, I envision, if you're fully insured, I would envision a certification from the carrier. What do you think about that, Tor? Well, the ones that are going to be the thornier ones are going to be the ones that are self-funded,
right,
who are going to have to work with their consultant, broker, attorney, actuary, or what have you, to come up with a valuation process. But, I mean, wouldn't you think that on the insurance side, the carriers would offer some sort of a certification that they meet?
The 50% accuracy.
Yeah.
I think that's right. And then it's going to be likely a review by... I suspect that you'll need a review by your TPA, your attorney, your broker, to make sure that you're complying with the restriction on lifetime maximums, annual maximums, that you've got all the right coverage provisions now.
Will large employers have to pay the no coverage penalty even if they don't offer health care coverage to part-time employees? And I know we've had a lot of questions come in from people as to how coverage is provided to part-time employees and how they're covered for purposes of the health care reform law.
They're included. Part-time employees are included in determining whether or not you are a large employer. So you have to use full-time equivalents to determine whether or not you have 50 or more employees. But the penalties are strictly keyed off of your full-time employee population.
Okay. All right. And I think at this point we are running out of time on our call. But again, we have posted resources, and as you can tell from some of the answers to these questions, the regulatory process by the agencies involved in the IRS.
IRS and Health and Human Services are the kind of the tripartite agencies that are involved here.
Okay, so we're going to be keeping very close track of what's going on in terms of guidance that's issued and so on, and we will keep updating information on that for you. Once again, we really appreciate your participation, and thanks very much for being with us today.